Writing, I'm very pleased to welcome you to our first professional development day for creative writing. We have a full day of events planned, so I'm hoping that many of you will be able to be here for the full onslaught of activities. We're starting this morning with an alumni panel, and this afternoon at 1:30, Joshua Nellman from the Walrus Magazine will be speaking. At 2:45, Jackie Kaiser of Westwood Creative Artists, and at 4:00, publisher Martha Sharp. And then this evening, the four alumni who are arranged before you this morning will be reading downstairs across the street in the DeSev Cinema at 7:30. I'd like to say before we begin that today's events would not be possible without the support of the Faculty of Arts and Science. Their funding has supported all of our Writers Read events this year. And I would also like to thank Kate Stearns for her role as co-organizer of the series, and also to thank MA Creative Writing students Katya Grubashik, almost right? I'll practice, it'll get better. And Sachiko Murakami for their help with today's events. I'd like to mention as well that although the author's books are not for sale this morning, they will be for sale tonight at the reading. But we do have copies of an anthology called 32 Degrees here, which was published in 1993, and it includes work by alumni of Concordia's creative writing program, including Nino Ricci and Mansell Robinson. So Sachiko, who's sitting in the front row here, waving kindly to you, will be selling copies for $12 after the reading, if you're interested. And those books will also be for sale tonight. I would now like to call upon Katya, who will be moderating this morning's panel, to introduce the participants and get things started.
I'll be the one picking fights. So first of all, I'd like to introduce all the panelists, and then we'll go to questions and just do a bit of a back and forth. It's going to be a pretty open discourse, so feel free to start with some small statements from the four of you, and then if anyone wants to jump in at any time, that's sort of, it's going to be a bit of a free-for-all, I guess, so we'll go with that. So first I want to introduce Catherine Kidd, who is from Montreal. And based in Montreal. She's the author of Sea Peach, which is a book and CD collection which was made with the DJ Jack Beats. Sea Peach won the Montreal English Critics Circle Award for Best New Text in 2003, and the show went to the Edinburgh Festival, Fridge Festival in 2004. It's also been featured on the radio and at festivals in the States, in England, and Norway, so it's gone pretty far afield. Catherine graduated from Concordia in 1998, and your thesis was Bestial Rooms, I believe, which is a novel, which is with Thomas Allen.
Which is getting a little long in the tooth in terms
right.
of its release, but
right.
it exists,
it's
and it will be out one
it's
of these days.
It's here in one version here, actually. I've got blackmail material. Everyone's thesis is sitting here, so if anyone would like to refer to your juvenilia, as it were. Anyway.
Marginalia.
Next to her is sitting Mansell Robinson, who is a playwright who's come to us from Saskatchewan today. He graduated from Concordia in 1992 with an MA in English, and his thesis was called Colonial Tongues, a play. He's also the author of Collateral Damage, The Heart as It Lives, Downsizing Democracy, Spitting Slag, Ghost Trains, and Street Wheat, and has two plays in the works of the moment, Picking Up Chekhov and Grease, Paint, and Gasoline, which will be performed in Calgary and Saskatchewan this year, respectively. And he'll be writing residence at the Regina Public Library later on this year as well. Maybe. Very nebulous life here. Next to him is Carmen Storino, who is a poet, essayist, critic, and the editor of Signal Editions, the poetry imprint of Vehicle Press. His first poetry collection, The New World, was nominated for the 1997 Q Spell A.M. Klein Prize and the Gerald Lampert Memorial Award. His second collection, Credo, won the 2001 Canadian Authors Association Prize and the David McKean Award from Concordia's Department of English. And last year, his most recent book of poetry, with English subtitles, won the A.M. Klein, the Quebec Writers Federation A.M. Klein Prize. He's also got a book of critical essays out called A Lover's Quarrel, and he was raised and still lives in Montreal. He graduated in 2000, and also blackmail material here for you. Finally, Nino Ricci, his first novel, Lives of the Saint, was his thesis in 1987, and it's garnered international acclaim. It's been published in dozens of languages, dozens of countries, and it's won, among other awards, the GG for Fiction, the Books in Canada First Novel Award, and the Betty Trask Award in England. It was followed by the other two books in the trilogy, In a Glass House and Where Has She Gone? And the last book, Where Has She Gone? Was nominated for the Gilbert Prize for Fiction. The whole trilogy was recently adapted for a television miniseries with Sophia Lorenz. I don't know how many other Concordia graduates can claim to have an his most recent novel, Testament, was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Prize for Canada and the Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize and the Pearson Canada Reader's Choice Award, and won the Trillium Award. He's originally from Ontario, of Italian parents, and now lives in Toronto, where he writes full time. So I guess we can go in that order, if you want to talk a little bit maybe about your experiences here and where you've gone since then. And then we'll open it up to questions.
Can I have a minute? Do you want to start with somebody else?
Yeah, sure. You just walk in. Why don't we start with Menzel?
It was a bit of a morning.
The question was, using the MA program as a starting point for a career trajectory. And in spite of my friends who say my trajectory is down, I think it's pretty safe to say that I wouldn't be a writer without coming to Concordia. I don't usually shill for institutions, especially in a province when you guys seem to be trying to shut them down. So I should be careful about that. But quite literally, I was 35 when I started the program. I had written a couple of plays. I thought I knew what I was doing. I didn't, which is why I entered the MA program, and I'm quickly cleared me up on that stuff. But I guess the main thing that happened to me here, I guess the most important thing is that over the 2 years, I was treated like a writer, and therefore I had to start to perform as a writer and start to look at myself as a writer, which essentially meant doing the work and doing the work and doing the work and redoing the work. So I think that was the big thing that I learned while I was here. In terms of what happened, I worked with Henry Beisel. I don't think he's here anymore. He was a poet and a dramatist at the time, and he was my thesis advisor. So we worked on my play for a couple years. And just by a couple of circumstances, the spring I graduated, that play was accepted at the Banff Playwrights Colony. So I got to work with professional actors for the first time. So kind of right from graduation day, I was working with professionals, but I wouldn't have had that ability, I think, without having those 2 years of needing to act and perform as a writer.
Come back to you at the end.
I don't mind going now or later. It does.
In order.
There was some distance. I started in the creative writing program here, and then left after I got my BA. I'd written some of the early poems in the New World, the first book, and I had made headway on the second book. And between leaving and coming back, I started writing reviews as well. Various newspapers, and coming back was really sort of was provoked. The decision to come back was provoked because of those two different things. I felt as though I needed. There was a gap between what I knew and what the wider world knew literarily, and I felt that I need to come back to school and learn how to think again, do research and read more carefully, more slowly. I was reading too quickly, I was reacting too intuitively, and I was getting into a bit of trouble with the new book, because I was trying to write a long poem, and I had never written one of those things before, and I know that Rob Allen was starting up his long poem class, and I thought it'd be cool to. Originally, I thought I could just sort of sit in on the class, and then I guess he suggested, "Why don't you just come back, do your MA?" So, sounded wise to me. So I did, and I actually had a great time. Some of the creative writing classes that I took were very good, very helpful, and particularly some of the courses I took. Two, especially one, a class with a Milton class with Judith Hertz. And my Othello class with Ed Pector, which sort of blew sort of things wide open for me, because they were both of them are exceptional teachers. And, And it was exactly what I needed, you know, in terms of, you know, my critical life, which is to return to the text and read closely and more deeply and learn how to unpack and, you know, what I was, in terms of the lines I was reading and all of that. So I actually think that the MA program, for me, I grew up in the MA program. I don't know if that makes any sense, but both, I think, as a poet and I don't know, maybe that would have happened regardless, I don't know, but it certainly happened when I was here, and certainly as, you know, in terms of the criticism I wanted to write, everything began to sort of dense up and make more sense here. And I think the classes I took accelerated the whole process as well. And the thesis was the, in fact, the second book.
Well, I suppose, like Nancy, or maybe a bit like you, Carmen, I really wouldn't have had a career, perhaps, without Concordia. I wrote Lives of the Saints here. I wrote it as a kind of whim, really. I didn't know what it took to write a book, but it remains my most successful book, and probably without it, I wouldn't be writing, certainly not for the time that I am now. I came to Concordia in a bit of a circuitous way. I had done an undergrad degree at York in English. I had gone to York partly for the creative writing program, though in my first year there I was told in no uncertain terms by W. Mitchell that I didn't have what it took to be a writer. Pursue a different career. Being the pig-headed person that I was, I didn't follow that advice. But it took me a while to sort of recover from that and sort of start writing in any kind of concerted way. I did a couple of creative writing courses after that at York, and then taught overseas for a couple of years, thinking I'd at some point begin writing, and I did sort of sporadically, but not, as I say, in any concerted way. And I came to Concordia with the idea what maybe I would begin here, although I was actually enrolled in the academic program at Concordia, not in the creative writing program. And I'd been here about a week, and I thought, well, this is kind of silly. I came here for creative writing, so maybe I'll try to switch into that program. And I went to Rob Allen, who was the head of the program at that point, and asked him if I could switch. He said, sure, you can try. and I went to a workshop of his, and I submitted a story, and it was a kind of a metafictional story about a window washer who falls to his death at the end of the story, but written as a kind of comedy, really. and I had various reactions. Some people liked the story, some people didn't. But someone in the class said, this seems to be a story about someone who wants to be a writer but is afraid to commit to it. I probably owe my career to that person. I don't know how he got that out of that particular story, but somehow he did, and I switched into the program after that class, after that workshop, and as I say, as a result of that, wrote Lives of the Saints. I was really fortunate in getting an advisor that I was able to work with. Terry Burns was my advisor, and he was someone who I brought work to from the start when I was thinking of going into the program and got feedback from. He was not an easy critic. He was the sort of person who could sort of find the one line in the story where the whole thing just fell apart. What is that word there? And you look at that word and you realize the whole edifice was faulty. It was really through him that I think I went through a kind of quantum leap in my writing, in that, particularly in the first year that I was here at Concordia, I seemed to understand things about writing that I hadn't understood till then. So. Again, it's hard to say whether some of those things might not have happened in some other way, but they happened here, and they happened also because, as Mansell was saying, that this was an environment that encouraged you to think of yourself as a writer. There were other people writing, there were people who took it seriously. There was a sort of culture that created the sense that this was not a worthless activity, and it was largely through the program. And this was also fortunate in the days when there was still some funding available for graduate students. So I was able to write almost full-time for 2 years by patching together various sources of funding, most of them by fallacious means. Because I'd applied in the academic program, I got most of my funding as an academic. Nobody knew that I'd actually switched into creative writing. But it allowed me to write almost on a full-time basis for 2 years. I stretched the program out as long as I could, as long as the funding was still there, and that was how I wrote Lives of the Saints.
Lives of the Saints is it was called Rita at the time, I guess, but it's the fairly daunting one for those of us who are writing, 80-page poetry pieces.
Sure. I would also say I came to Concordia via a rather circuitous route. I think probably the biggest thing that I learned here was that writing as a practice, as a career, as a lifestyle, may be the only thing, because I tried plenty of other things previously, which was broad enough to incorporate all the different things I was interested in. I mean, I think I came here almost like washed up on a beach after trying various different things that I thought would sort of answer these questions. I came here wanting to have the right conversation, that would sort of illuminate what I'd pursued previously and tie it all together. I started out as the first 20 years of my life, which is still more than half of it, but barely, all I wanted to do was act, and I got a lot of encouragement in that, which isn't necessarily helpful. Like you say, a lot of encouragement isn't necessarily helpful because you might feel like, well, I guess I'm obligated to do that then. And I went to acting school, and it was really fun, very physical, very vacuous. They didn't want me to think a lot in there. And so it was kind of like all body, no mind thing. And I got very disillusioned because this was what I'd sort of invested, since four, wanting to do. And I quit and went, okay, if they keep telling me I think too much, that's fine. I'll go into philosophy then. I'll go into philosophy and religious studies. Or the religious studies came later to sort of add a spiritual dimension to it. So I quit acting school, really rudely, very suddenly. I just sort of said, I've had it with this. I did a skit in one of my acting classes about René Descartes and what a jerk I thought he was. And they said, well, why don't you just go to philosophy then? And I said, all right, I will. And I went to that, but then, talk about Cartesian splits there. I mean, if acting school was all body and no mind, now I was in this pursuit that was gorgeous in the world of ideas, but just didn't have its feet on the ground, didn't feel grounded in anything physical, that I still wanted to crawl around in the mud, not only, sort of savor these beautiful ideas. I gave up altogether on school for a while, and I took off to India, where I thought I started auditing classes at Banaras Hindu University, sort of emphasizing the religious studies aspect of it. And I ended up staying in India for 2 years, more not going there with a purpose, discovering what my purpose was the longer I stayed there, which was kind of my experience at Concordia as well. There were parallels there, definitely. And it just sort of started to feel like, why was it here? I was in India, where sights and sounds and smells and everything was so pressing and so prescient and demanding a response. And I was still sort of talking about these ephemeral ideas. And then I'd leave the university, and there would be, the cows and the streets and the mud and the flowers and the beautiful colors. And it didn't make sense any longer to write about these very abstract floating things when the physical world was so much more interesting. And so I thought, right, well, maybe I should. I knew of Montreal as this kind of mecca for writing, for arts at all. I was born in Quebec in the rural, in the eastern townships, but we moved out west when I was really young. So it was in Vancouver that I went to acting school, and in Whitehorse. And then I came here just sort of, as I say, washed up on a beach. I had applied for religious studies at McGill, and I had applied for creative writing at Concordia. And then it was almost last minute, flip of the coin, no, this is what I'm going to do. And over time, I mean, I'm kind of going on a bit now, but over time I saw that I could bring all of those loves, all of those past loves, lost relationships in a way, if you will, to play in this practice. I could talk about the beautiful ideas, and I could, use as many colors as I wanted in my writing. And then eventually, that's why I reappropriated the acting experience from way back when and started performing these stories and working with music and working more and more movement into it. And I think that writing is great because it's vast. It's not a specific thing. It's not, you know, a language. It's language at all, you know. And I guess that's sort of tracing a history. And so here, you know, I found, like, I could disappear into my head, go home and write stuff, or I could be at the school where there were people around and a sense of community. It wasn't the writer alone in her garret, and it neither was it this sort of, you know, the workshop is supposed to reduce everything to the same level. It was, like, everything. And so, and then I ended up staying for my MA because somebody encouraged me to and helped me pay for it, too. So, yeah, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. In the end, yeah.
Well, all four of you have obviously very different concerns from the visceral or the sort of social, very leftist concern in Mansell's work. And you're all going on about exile and language and sort of reclaiming these lost words or the historical and historiographical. But maybe your comment, Catherine, about the workshop ethos is a good place to start the discussion on a more pragmatic level. I know, Nino, you referred to the problem of workshop ease, and I'm sure we've all experienced this sort of, it can be either a reduction or an augmentation of our work, and I think that you're right in pointing out, Nino, that sometimes, you know, you hear these lines, like I think you've said, I'm not sure you've earned that cliche, or things like, this line isn't really working hard enough for you. And poems that we sometimes, or works that we otherwise would see in print and think, hey, this is a great poem, and I can engage that on its own level. You see it on the page of the workshop, and all of a sudden you feel compelled to pick it apart. And so I wonder if instead of asking, this is the ongoing question, of course, but instead of maybe asking whether a workshop is worthwhile, maybe how you've made workshops worthwhile, and whether you've taken that experience after Concordia, whether you work in workshop in groups now, or whether you have, so how you've adapted that, the strengths of workshopping processes to your writing in general. It's kind of an enormous question, but.
Well, I'm actually, the last thing I wanted to do, I mean, since I had started the creative writing in the creative writing program and then left it, I went back into the program knowing, full well what to expect. When I left it the first time, the last thing I wanted was to go back. I mean, I tried to stay away from workshops entirely. And when I went back to the MA program, I mean, I knew that that was involved. It was a bit of a shock the second time around because I guess I didn't know enough the first time to be shocked. But the second time, I was shocked because I was in a class with students who were actually quite proud of what they didn't know. I mean, the basic stuff. I mean, I was shocked that people had never read Philip Roth, for example, never read Philip Larkin. Jeffrey Hill, vaguely knew. Seamus Heaney, Paul Muldoon, Elizabeth Bishop. I mean, I was in a poetry class with people who had never actually read, Margaret Addison, Leighton. It was a bit of, for me, it's like taking a religion class and saying, Moses, anyone? And so it was difficult for me to actually offer my poems up to people who were like, working very hard at trying to explain to me why it wasn't working, when I knew that the last thing they read was like Howl, even now, I'm sure I can go around the room and ask, who the last Canadian poet someone purchased, and I think I can embarrass a fair amount of people here. So for me, that was a bit of a surprise. Not so much the first time, but the second time it was. And I knew, that I had to sort of keep quiet or it was just going to be ugly. So, nonetheless, I got lots of good feedback. Sometimes it's, the editing process is a good one because even stuff you don't accept toughens you up for the decisions that you've made. So you know why you've done certain things, and because you've had to defend that decision. And the defense, I think, of certain decisions is a powerful experience. I think rather than sort of accepting all the changes and coming back with like
the McPoem.
The McPoem, yeah. although I don't think creative writing classes have, I think the McPoem is what creates it is a much larger phenomenon than just the creative writing classes.
I was going to say, when I saw that question on the list of possible questions for discussion, I thought, it didn't seem to be that so much that happened as what you said about how a poem that if you saw it in a book, you might say, fine poem, but as soon as it's put in front of you in the workshop situation, where what you're meant to do is see what happens if you pull this stick and see how it just falls apart. I mean, it almost seems like you're supposed to be trying to find some problem with it, like going to a psychiatrist, you know? Anybody sitting in front of that set of criteria and that particular lens is going to be neurotic. And any poem put before a workshop situation, don't you agree, like seems to be, well, I'm supposed to find a problem with it. And then there's going to be one. I mean, you see what you're looking for, you know, I think.
I think it's more useful to ask how it's operating, not how it's flawed necessarily. But.
Yeah.
Aside from having one workshop where I fought with one person every day, I was able to use that rage to write a story, which had nothing to do with that, but it was a very, I thought, it was, anyway, it was a good angry story, so
yeah.
Use it that way. But what I found was, if I could find one person in a workshop who sort of got what I was up to, and was asking the right questions, sort of like what you're talking about with Terry, then it was a successful workshop. Actually, Ray Boschman, who's at the back, he's the foreign editor for the Gazette. He was in my first fiction workshop, and he was the guy who seemed to ask the right questions, and so that's how I made it useful. Maybe it blinded me to certain other criticisms that may have also been useful, but for me it was finding one relationship that, so then you're not falling into that trap of trying to write for everyone, because you can't. So that's my take on that. And I agree, I don't know what a McStory is, and I don't know what a McPoem is. I really don't know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
But if that can be defined, that would be interesting. Then I would know.
Well, I'd have to say that I don't think there's been more than one or two pieces that I've had workshop that I've actually gone back to. So I, when someone's in a workshop, it's sort of contaminated for me. It's so that might be seen as a drawback, I guess, of the workshop system. At the same time, you know, I've learned a lot of what I've learned about writing from workshopping. You know, even in those cases where, I don't know where you got that.
It was an interview, I think, that you...
I see.
What?
That, well, my quote, but, yeah. But even in workshops like that, where you've got, and sometimes people are too experienced in workshops. The particular workshop that I was thinking about in that case was probably the best workshop I ever did, because they were people who were not proud of what they didn't know,
yeah.
Who knew a fair amount, who'd been through workshops, who were very serious about writing, who were writing well, and who were really challenging you in real ways. We had a great instructor in the class with Clark Blaze, who brought a lot of knowledge to the table, and I learned a tremendous amount in that workshop. I don't take my stuff to be workshopped now, but I teach workshops, and my sense is that every workshop takes on its own mood. And I've had workshops that just have not worked at all. They just don't come together for whatever reason. The personalities are wrong, or it just never takes off. And then other ones where there is that mood, and where people, I've seen students sort of make those quantum leaps, where they've gone from writing stuff that was just sort of competent in terms of writing sentences, but there was nothing there. And, you know, 3 months later, they're producing these beautiful stories, and something has happened in them. It's hard to say whether the workshop process has made that happen, but certainly that's been part of the mix. So I think that can happen to people. And the other side of them is that they do provide that supportive environment. When I'm teaching, you know, 1 week workshops, you can't expect in a week to know enough about the writer, really, to know what they are capable of and where they can go with their work. Most people come into a workshop thinking, this person's going to tell me if I can be a writer. But you can't do that as an instructor. Certainly that's been my experience from teachers I've had. But you can, I mean, I think what a workshop should ultimately do is inspire you to keep writing. If you go away feeling defeated and paralyzed, that's not the right thing. But if you come out of it feeling excited about writing, and I think workshops can often do that, then I think it's had the effect that it's one of the best effects it can have.
Yeah, but it's funny that, you know, some of the people that I came up with workshops with, who are far better writers, far smarter, work harder, have disappeared. There is something about workshops that is sort of a false environment, and certain personalities that just can't survive outside of it won't write again. And I've never understood that. I've always thought about it, but you know, I think of two people particularly in my head who are excellent poets. I mean, who well-read and ambitious, and when they left, I mean, it disappeared with them. I'm not sure, and it happens again and again. I mean, I've seen that in other situations, and I'm not sure what it is about the workshopping and the, because it's not that way in the academic realm. I mean, you know, the academic superstars go on to, like, you know, to do other things. And they're still part of that, you know, that whole, you know, intellectual economy, so to speak, adding to it, you know, and paying back into it. But for the writers, it's a different thing.
It seems like for me that story is true. I can think of, you know, a few people who I just thought were great, and you know, have been in an unhappy job that doesn't have anything to do with writing for the last 10 years. But then on the other hand, if I think about the people who I know, have known the longest here in Montreal, and who are my closest friends, a lot of them, I said, well, how long have we known each other anyway? And it traces back to Concordia workshops, like, you know, Corey Frost, for instance, you know. And so it's so funny because, I mean, part of writing is such a solitary undertaking, and I wouldn't be surprised if most people sitting in a workshop are sort of like, well, there's me and then there's the rest of them. Me, I'm just sort of studying this process. I think a lot of writers sort of feel like that they're observing the workshop environment while everybody else is participating in it. You know? But that's part of participating in it, I think, and realizing that if it was just you sitting in that room, nothing at all would be happening in terms of the workshop. And there's a sense of community that, for me, has been really, really necessary to, I mean, to surviving as a writer person. Emphasis on the person, because writing by itself, I just think I would be so lonely. And so feeling like I'm part of this community, which has continued over the years. Maybe there's only a couple of them, you know? Maybe there's only a couple of people.
But then the rest of them, what do they do with a degree?
Well,
that's what I mean, you know,
But I mean, university, you're supposed to be wrestling with that question. So maybe at the, you know, maybe at the end of it, it's like, I'm going to apply this method to some other pursuit.
But like, you know, think of it.
Like car mechanics, I don't know.
Two decades of creative writing programs. I mean, this is not including the one that Earl Burney started at UBC. Hasn't led to any more readers for poetry or fiction. It's still at the same level it was, you know, in the 60s or 70s. A book of poetry in this country is lucky if it breaks a ceiling of 300 copies. A novel is lucky if it breaks a ceiling of like 700 copies. It hasn't changed. This is, you know, thousands of creative writing students who have gone through, like,
could be worse. Could have gone down. We could have been totally eliminated.
Or you could look at it according to other criteria altogether than the numbers of books.
I don't think that's true at all. I think there's a much greater readership, particularly for Canadian writing now, than there was 30 years ago. 30 years ago.
But you're talking about global, and it's fiction. It's not, you know, particular kinds of fiction.
I can't speak to poetry, but certainly fiction is much more widely read now in Canada than it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, there were no.
Yeah.
You know, 30 years ago, there were maybe five writers who were selling, you know, 1,000 copies of the book.
Does that have to do with creative writing programs?
But it's hard to say what role creative writing programs are.
Well, if they don't produce writers, do they produce readers? Do they produce, I mean, like, you know, I have, I know a man, you know, he works as a correctional officer. He got his MA in history, and then he went off and did something else. Very smart man, applies everything he reads, everything he knows, everything he experiences, you know, applies, you know, his history degree. It's his prism, and he reads everything through it. Obviously, it was an extremely enriching experience for him, intellectually so, and so he is, I think, the better person intellectually for it. Now, someone who gets an MA creative writing degree, what are they, I mean, I just don't know. It's hard for me to see if they, you know, all these MA students we're producing, creative writing students we're producing in the country, what, I mean, how, it was one of the questions I think that was given to us. I think it's an important question. What comes next if they're not going to, like, if they can't write books, and they won't write books, and they don't go on to review or write criticism or even teach? I mean, you know, what can one take away from a creative writing program? You know, those students, for example, in your class, they make those quantum leaps and never go on to write again. You know, are they a better person for it?
But maybe in a lot of cases, it seems like it's not about compromising your ideals so much as it's about your rent or something. I'm quite serious. I mean, I'm quite serious. When I finished the program, I was like, I got offered a contract for a novel before I had the novel, and I had to make a really, really hard decision. If I was going to jump at this meant literally couch surfing friends' houses, you know, beans and rice and beans and rice and beans and rice, and not going out to clubs, not going out for drinks, not doing anything like that. And yikes. I mean, if I think about the friend who's got a miserable job, he moved to Toronto after the program. What else is he supposed to do but spend most of his time paying for his rent? And I think that that's a reality, right? Like, maybe somebody graduates thinking, I'm going to be a writer, but it's rare. And I mean, when I do teach workshops, I have to talk about the beauty of writing as well as this part of it. Are you able to make a living doing what you do? Yeah, now. It was in my 30s, I would say, that happened. I mean,
30.
I was broke ass. I am lucky. I consider myself very lucky. But I mean, damn, I was poor for a long time. And that had to do with choosing this pursuit. And a lot of people aren't willing to do that or are not able to do that
I'm not complaining because the MA program isn't leading to more writers. I'm just curious to know what one takes away from an MA program in creative writing. If one won't and can't go into, like, you know, you graduate and then you have to pay the rent. We all have to pay the rent, you know. But how has it changed you? How does it alter you? You know, what are the practical effects in your own life of having this degree? You know, if it actually doesn't lead to, like, you know, greater sales for other people who've gone on to write, does it? I mean, I'm just curious to know, or maybe this is the wrong question. I don't know. Maybe
I think you're asking as an editor as well as a writer.
It doesn't lead to better citizens. It hasn't helped. It hasn't helped. There have been no
better
great politicians that have come out of MA programs. It hasn't helped sort of the voting process. The public debates are as dreary and as dim-witted as they always have been. Do you know what I mean? Like, all these students who have come out of MA programs and the workshop experience, I mean, all these minds that have been, like, sort of, you know, creating the crucible of this of the workshop, you know, the workshop experience. What happens to them?
Let's hear from the crucible, maybe.
I'm in the MA program in prose. I can't obviously offer any kind of statistical answer to your question, but I think, for one thing, it takes time, and I think that the kind of structural basis of this program, in that we read each other's work. I read Malcolm's and Zach's and Johanna's work, and I'm informed by their work. I really, you know, I gain by that process, and it informs my writing, and it informs my citizenship or whatever. But it does take time. I mean, I won't have a published book for however many decades or years. And, you know, then people will be affected by that. It is a network, and because this program is set up structurally as a network, I think it can't not have an effect. It can't not spread. It's slow. I mean, is that something of an answer?
Yes, yeah, but but I knew that already. I mean, because that was part of the program.
I know poetry sales are this.
But my question is, what can you take away from an MA program that doesn't help you network or schmooze or what is it that a network an MA pro what
what
what can you
does it teach you essentially?
I mean, like, what skill does it give you that has. You know, that doesn't help you with the networking and the schmoozing.
Well, it's not a business program. I mean,
no, but intellectually, even how does it help you when you read?
I'm not writing in a vacuum. If you consider that Toronto, especially, less so in Montreal, but it's a small country, and the writing community in any given center is small, and it's often what is the word? Insulated. Mm-hmm. It's hard to break in. By its very nature, the workshop is a democratic process. I mean,
because I can pay the tuition and be here for 2 years, I basically have access to a writing community that I might not otherwise have if I'm, you know, the typical shy writer, for example.
Is one possible segue, maybe, I know, Matt, so you were at the Dawson City, the Pierre Burton House program, and I wonder if that's maybe one possible segue out of this kind of program that maybe enables people to make that leap from writing in a workshop and being really successful in a workshop to, you know, to bridge that gap between those who keep writing and those who don't. I wonder if, I think you've been, have you been at Banff as well? Or have
no,
you
no, I was at the Burton House as well.
Were you?
Yeah.
I wonder if you maybe can address that as a possible segue or as a possible sort of remedy to fill a stopgap kind of between...
No, I want to get back to the question of what, because it's bigger than the workshop, but literature, to me, I mean, art is supposed to be useless, but I actually think it's about empathy. I think that's what, that's the one thing we can actually learn from literature, studying it, reading it, playing with it, whatever. But in terms of the workshop, like I don't teach workshops, but what I find amazing is 12 people in a room given the same assignment, same small assignment, and you will get 12 absolutely different points of view on it. And I think that's fantastic, and I think that's amazing for people to see. Now, how that literally translates into the political realm, or I'm not quite sure, but it's...
Or the emotional realm.
Or the emotional, yeah. But it's a great thing to experience, because we can get trapped into our own... You know, into our own ruts. If you know, we're working with carpenters all the time, so we talk like carpenters. But when you get those multiple perspectives, I just find it intriguing and very human and hopefully useful down the road. I agree with the lady there that I think it's a hugely slow process.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, I just like the multiple perspectives.
But it is about the process and not the goal, I think, and not the piece of paper that you're going to hang on your wall after. I mean, it's about the... I mean, I've been making a jigsaw puzzle recently, and it's a picture of a bass jumping in a mayfly, and that picture is already on the box. You know, I don't need to make the thing at all. And it takes a hell of a long time, and, you know, and I've been sort of looking for the metaphors in everything I say about this puzzle, kind of going, you know, no, there's not enough pieces here. I swear to God, some of them are missing. They must be under the couch. You know, and then you make this thing, and you've got friends doing it with you and whatever. And once it's done, it looks just like the box, and you can hang it on the wall, and it's not really worth it more than the paper it's printed on. But that's not why you buy a jigsaw puzzle anyway. And so, you know, I was thinking about these questions and just happened to be doing this jigsaw puzzle, and it just seemed rife with metaphors, which anything does if you look at it carefully. And you know, talk about process-oriented. I think that the workshops are very much about that. Learning the skills to put the thing together. Not putting this actual thing together. That's been done a million times. But learning...
But it's not like
to look at each piece from different angles, to look, you know, all of those things.
I mean, I went through a liberal arts program, and it was quite rigorous at Dawson. And, I mean, you know, we read straight from, we started anonymous all the way down to, like, you know, to Descartes and Hume and you know, and I came away from that knowing with lots of very useless things, I guess, that I applied to everything in my life. but the workshop experience, I mean, I could apply to nothing except the next workshop experience. I'm just asking, I'm not trying to provoke anything other than, like, just...
No.
Sitting in a group, though, and talking.
Yeah.
Do we have all these, you know, there in any given workshop, there's, you know, the one person goes on the right and 12 who feel like losers the rest of their lives? Is that the question? Because they haven't been the ones to succeed.
No, actually, I'm not encouraging any loserdom here. I don't want anybody to feel badly, you know, after they leave the program. I'm just curious to know what they've learned in the program and how, if there's anyone here actually who's like, hasn't gone on, I want to speak to someone who's like graduated in the MA program, hasn't gone on to write, has done other things, and their experience in the MA program, creative writing, has made them, in whatever small way, a better person. I know it's like a vague term, probably very cliche, but, you know, I think everyone here knows what I mean by that. So, and...
Right. Well, let me speak. I mean,
yeah.
I think similar to what Catherine was saying, that I've been writer in residence for a library in Northern Toronto, and I had a lot of people coming in who were a lot of older people who had not done any writing in their lives, or decided to write their life story, or something like that, or write a novel. And this was something that was a complete departure from what they did in their lives. It involved, you know, completely different mental faculties, but was probably sort of one of the most essential things they've done in their lives, because it forced them to try and make sense of the world in a different way. It forced them to try and put things together in that way, and it exercised and occupied a mental faculty that does, I think, increase things like empathy. It does increase, you know, your sense of how you make meaning in the world, your sense of what is meaningful in the world. And I mean, those other 11 people in the workshop, well, should they have studied economics? Would that have made them better people?
Maybe.
Well, it might have got them a job.
Yeah.
But
well,
that's taking a very
support.
Kind of bottom line kind of view of what value an activity has in your life. I mean, I learned things in creative writing workshops that I didn't learn in my literature classes. In your literature classes, you put things on a pedestal. You look at literature in a very particular way. When I was at Concordia, when I was graduating, I taught a course in literature, and what struck me was the great gap between how I wrote and how literature gets taught. That there's a disconnect there. That often literature is not taught in ways that are meaningful. You talk about theme, you talk about common themes in a national literature, and so on. Things that are interesting to learn about, but they don't necessarily get you to the heart of what it is to write. When I was in a workshop, the first time I did a workshop, it was the first time it opened my mind to, you know, the actual nuts and bolts of how you create something. And that is, I think that's a pretty essential.
Maybe let's take a question from the second row.
I was just going to say, I write not because I want to get an MA or because I want somebody in my class to say that what I write is good. I write because I love it. And you do too, right? You write because you love the process of writing. So
it's
at the end of the day,
money, that's why.
You're going to go out into the world and you're going to put your stuff out there if you're lucky enough to get published. And you'll do it whether or not you get published or not, because you want to write. You're writing because it's a part of who you are. So I don't think it matters whether the readership increases across Canada in terms of how many sales you make, but it matters that people have the artistic ability to write and to feel that somebody else is reading their stuff. And in a creative writing program, you get to see where your strengths are. Like somebody in my class might say, oh, I disagree with this, you wrote this in the wrong way and you should change it to look like this. I might not agree with them, but I can see their perspective, and then you change or not change that piece of writing, or you stick to your guns and you carry on with it. Mm-hmm. You know, you just get something back from having been a part of that process. But if you are a writer, you will become a writer. Those people that go on with their MAs and don't become writers, why don't they become writers? Because their heart is not in it, because they haven't got the courage to put it out there, or they might still be writing at home.
So raise the question, I guess, of whether people come into creative writing programs and those who leave as writers were writers to begin with, or whether it can in fact be taught, as you were asking. Maybe take another quick question and then we'll come back to you guys. Delman and Beth.
Yeah, thanks. I'm just wondering, I'm thinking about what people go into school for, and when they try to go into a creative writing program, it may be that they need that sort of discipline and time to write, and those sort of imposed goals that are laid on them, right? Like, it's difficult to write on your own. And so people often go into school for that sort of security and those imposed goals. And at the same time, it seems like, I'm not sure how much of your programs were based on the workshop situation, like as opposed to now. I'm guessing that they're similar, and there was a lot of workshop activities that were happening. And so maybe that there were maybe too much of these workshop activities. That's sort of the feeling that I'm getting from you, Carmen, that maybe...
No, actually, the best class I took at Concordia, as you know, and one that helped me most in writing poetry, was the Milton class I took with Judith Hertz. We read Milton, we read that poem so closely, and she was so, it was incredible the way she would hair split a line. You know, I mean, she would break it down. You know, we would talk about why it worked, why it didn't work sometimes, because you know, that poem has, you know, lots of moments that just don't work. And the best class I took as someone who went on to write criticism was this Othello class with Ed Pector, where we read the play in terms of how critics read the play, and I, you know, that was sort of a mind oxygenating thing for me. The workshops themselves, I learned more from reading Thomas Hardy than I did from any of the workshops that I was in. But the workshops themselves, in terms of the camaraderie and the friendships and the conversations that went on afterwards and before, or the beers that, you know, we had, like, you know, the day after the work, that's what I remember. That's what I took away with me from my experience. There were moments certainly in the workshops that were quite helpful in terms of the poems that I was bringing in. But it was all the ancillary stuff, all that outside marginal stuff that I enjoyed, and that, you know, so the workshop experience, learning how to comment on somebody else's poem, you know, I found was something that was quite, you know, negligible as a skill for me, and I never, you know, it's not something I use again, except, you know, when I do teach workshops, you know, and then, you know, my experience as being a workshop student, and I enters into it, and I know that certain things need to be done in order to create the mood and all of that. But I remember taking a class with Robert Allen on this long poem, and he brought in a reading list, and two people said, "Do we have to read this?" And it just shocked me that, you know, that it, you know, it was a. They felt as though it was suffering for them to actually read these long poems. And that that reading list, had any of them done it, would probably have done them more good than the class itself, I think. Because, you know, at its heart, I think writing is autodidactical. I think it's you and the page and the reading that you've done and you know, and the tradition that you are sort of measuring yourself against or breaking away from, you know. But workshops, I think, you know, it's a political thing. It's a process thing. It's, you want the degree. You need it for money. Or the world is just too tough for you that you need, you know, these false imposed goals in order to get work writing done, which is fine. You know, it certainly helped Nino when he got his book done. So, but
that's,
I think
what I understand from what you're saying. I'm just wondering if maybe the workshops are more of like a self-help groups, you know, maybe they turn into that.
Absolutely.
If there are too, the emphasis is too great on that, because I agree with your, with what you're saying, you know, there should be more reading and maybe time spent by yourself, because once you leave the program, you know, it's up to you to maybe keep up those relationships that you've made in school, but you also, if you're going to be a writer, you have to be stuck in your room for however long doing that, unless you don't want to do it.
Well, James Baldwin used to write his books apparently at parties. I mean, he needed like noise and bustle. You know.
But
so
if I'm not mistaken, you only have to do one workshop to graduate creative writing. I hardly felt there was an overemphasis on workshops.
Yeah.
You did the one workshop. I was surprised at how little workshop there was.
But I didn't say there was overemphasis
on my own.
I never said.
Okay, yeah. That's my impression.
Yeah.
And most of the other courses were, you know, academic courses.
Yeah.
Books, of course, they're required to read books, so I published them.
Yeah, but I never said the word.
There's a question in the back also that we can go to.
Yeah.
So, I
have a hand up. I guess I just wanted to address the question of whether it makes you a better person. Like, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, I'll answer it anyway.
If workshops made people better dressers, that'd be good.
That would be great. I guess
I
like
have a Chavez still if I wasn't there.
I mean, I guess, like, to me, it just it's I think it can teach you just a lot of respect for what other people are doing, and just like a manner of approaching other people. Like you're saying, you know, if you don't go on to become a writer and you don't go on to workshop other poems, but you mean your life is like continuously workshopping what everyone around you is doing all the time, right? And like I think it's just like the experience of having, I mean, especially if you have people in your workshop who are doing things you don't like, they come in every week and they sit this thing in front of you and you go, God, this is horrible, you know. But you have to come in and you have to say something respectful and you have to think of, you know, constructive and think of something that's going to help them. And I think that's something you carry over for sure into the other things that you do. It's just like, you know, it's like even just, I feel like my old workshop teacher used to love the phrase, I wonder about, you know, and I think you use that for other stuff too. Like, I wonder about that dress you're wearing, for example, you know, rather than that's ugly.
I just want to add to that. I mean, I totally agree, but I don't think it's just in the realm of writing. I think that everybody, and this is something I've learned from writing as a metaphor, everybody is here to and wants to tell their own story in some way or another. You know, whatever you end up doing, if you love it, if you really love it, then it's because it's your way of telling your story. Maybe that incorporates your mother's story, her mother's, your father's, his father's. Writers, because it's language that we love, you know, take the metaphor to be the message. And so if we're going to, you know, tell our story, so to speak, we're going to do it literally, damn it, and with words, you know. But if the process of studying that practice, you know, doesn't teach you like a sort of excitement and respect and love for other people's way of telling. I mean, my mother was, oh, I'm not a creative person. I can't draw. But, you know, she volunteers at Downtown Eastside Vancouver Church, and you wouldn't believe the story she pulls out of people, what she's able to offer them back, and it has everything to do with love and everything to do with empathy, I think.
I think too much love is a bad thing.
No, I don't. I used
Jesus
to.
Didn't love everybody.
Yeah, he did. He just wasn't really nice to everybody necessarily. But that's part of. I mean, that's part of it. Like, I mean, I remember finding not long ago this tiny little scrawl in a notebook I had when I was 16, and I was a really depressed person when I was 16. That a list that said over and over again, you know, like all work and no play, said, "I am an artist. I am an artist. I am." There was no content, only the form, and. You know, it's really necessary to have some sort of structure, some sort of encouragement to make you, you know, fill in what you want to say to whatever the medium you've chosen is.
I wonder if we could maybe extend this, the workshop conversation, also to the theatrical realm for a second before we return to questions, because it seems to me that the process of constructing a play involves other people in maybe a similar way that the workshop does, or I wonder how much of the sort of writer and his Garrett experience you were able to mesh with the more community-oriented workshopping process?
I think that's one reason I like the theater is, it is the community. When I get to rehearsal or workshop, first, I'm dead. I don't have anything else. I hate the work. It's awful. I have no ideas. And then 8 or 10 people bring in new energy. But also, they really are using it. They ask different questions. So when you're talking about different parts of, you know, the brain or the soul or whatever, actors ask different questions about the same piece of writing. A director will ask different questions, and it's and I have to learn to answer them. Answer them in a different way. I'm just as at a very simple level, what reads fine on the page. Coming out of an actor's mouth is a totally different language. What your brain reads very smoothly is absolute gobbledygook coming out of an actor's mouth. It's whether it's just difficult to say, whether it's just, you know, whether it's just false or whatever. But it's the language does shift when it becomes live, which is why poetry readings or readings in general are often a very different kind of experience.
It provides a forum for reading as well, I guess, the program does. There's a woman back here who has a question.
Yeah, I just wondered if you ever felt like you had to write something really meaningful and not just go and write for what you feel like or like eternity and stuff like that.
Maybe
do you always look for a meaning?
We maybe start with the man who rewrote the story of Jesus.
That's a...
I mean, you always hope what you're writing is meaningful because you hope that your own thoughts have some kind of value to them. But I hate when anyone comes to me and says, can you write something about this? Or, like, I can't do that. Or I have done it, and I always hate what I've done subsequently. So the ideas I get are ideas that, you know, come to me and sit in my mind and sit there for years, usually. And so I would hope that they have meaning, therefore, because I've thought about them for a while. But they're not, it's not because I've thought, oh, I have to write something with meaning. It's because, you know, I have my own screwed up obsessions, you know, that probably have to do with all the humiliations I suffered back in high school. And I'm still working out in some way. But that's what directs me to material that's real for me. So it's not... It's not like I sit down and say, okay, what's a meaningful subject out there? So, you know, I wrote about Jesus because, you know, when I was 7 years old, I wanted to be Jesus. And I thought, maybe I am Jesus, who knows? And it turned out I wasn't, but...
Don't sound too disappointed.
But that stayed with me. It was, you know, it had that deep personal connection. Otherwise, I, you know, just say, oh, that's an important story. I'm going to write about that because it's important. It wouldn't work.
Mansell, do you want to have a crack at that one as well? You certainly write from a very socially active empire.
I do, but I've written some very political stuff, and but also, you know, trying to find the human in it. But I mean, you're. There's nothing wrong if you sit there and laugh at a line that you've written. There's also nothing wrong if you sit there and cry at a line that you've written.
Shows.
I mean, where do I go with this? A friend of mine wanted to work on a play together, so he just sent me some stuff over the email, and it's just a goofy story about two writers, but it was fun, and we, you know, hopefully something, you know, surfaced in it that's more than fun, but. Yeah, I agree. It's you don't. The meaning comes later, and sometimes that's somebody else's problem. If you know what I mean? It's what's the story? You're trying to find the story, and you can't really find the meaning until you find the story, I guess. So I don't know.
It can't really be injected. Do you mean that? It's not like meaning is like the little fortune cookie ticket inside the thing.
Yeah,
it's
like in a play, like that's the thing that will be cut. Everybody will go, like,
yeah.
No, it's on the nose, man. It's on the, you know, you just said it. Why do the play? You just said it. So cut that speech and let's see the characters living that idea or whatever.
That seems to be true.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Does the MA as opposed to MFA program, do you think, build that editorializing into your work in a negative or positive way? Like, does the reading process make you a better reader of your own work, or does it make you try to write, you know, in a way that will provide fodder for undergraduate essays?
A good workshop, if it's led by a good workshop leader, will make you a better reader of your work. Yeah, I think it will.
The autodidacticism again.
What?
The autodidactic.
Yeah, I mean, particularly if you're in a situation where you think you know your own mind, which is sometimes a false thing, but it's always nice to sort of believe that, and you're defending your work. I think that, again, that defense, that rushing to, like, you know, to protect what you've done, if it's done in the right spirit, can actually make you a very good reader of your own work. Yeah, that's the most difficult thing, I think, and certainly the editing process. It's important to. You know, it's the most important thing is when you start reading your work the way somebody else reads it, and that a good editor does that. I think good editor gives you back the poem the way the world would read it, or at least a sizable amount of it. You know, or at the very least the way you would read it, and not just, you know, the poet himself.
I want to talk to you later about the simultaneous publication of your criticism and your book of poetry.
But the workshops, I think, are useful for that. I mean, we're talking about usefulness. I think they're useful to make you improve your own relationship to your work.
That's another question right over here. Do you have any questions?
No, I was just going to mention the activities of writing are very subjective, and besides the problem of financial and other vicissitudes, there's also a problem of maybe the reader not finding, I mean, the writer not finding the right audience. Kafka, I think, was the one who threw his stuff in the fire and somebody saved it. He never got published. And there, I mean, having been in workshops, you go, well, gee, this person never gets published or doesn't, you know, is not worthy. So there's that element of, unfortunately, you know, people not having enough talent or not finding the right audience. That could explain also what's going on.
And I think that you're...
But there's an empowerment level you were mentioning.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that your motives for doing it need to change and evolve over the process of a workshop, too. Like, performance is a great example or metaphor for this, that I think anyone who's a performer, okay, this means that you want to stand up in front of a bunch of people and do something and be applauded. You start out, maybe, because you want that approval. You want external approval. It's necessary, and you crave it. But that can't continue to be your reason, or you're dead in the water. You know, and I think that writing is the same way, that if you might start out with, you know, I'm going to write the great Canadian novel or whatever, and I'm going to get accolades and prizes, and people are, I'll feel really understood, and, you know, I'll illuminate some. But those can't continue to be your reasons for doing it. Or you're just living in way too fragile a house, do you know what I mean? Like, if the process of writing doesn't teach that out of you, so that you just, no, I have to like this. I have to like this now. I have to like this book, whether it gets published or doesn't get published, and enjoying the process of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know that my motives have really changed in doing the art that I do. Like, you start out as a child just wanting somebody to, you know, as a child, wanting somebody to pat you on the head and say you're understood, you did good. But that can't continue to be your reason. Like the training wheel of workshops in universities, like once that's off, are you still going to do it?
I also get the feeling in your case, there's nothing else you could do. Is that correct?
Do you mean in that, yeah, I have no marketable skills, except typing. do you mean in terms of it's something that's kind of, it's compelled, is that what you mean?
Right.
Breathing, yeah. As opposed to the only default.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
I just want to address this whole why are we doing this question a little bit. I also think that it's about meaning, like creating meaning. That's what we're doing when we're writing, is seeing what's important and saying, this is meaningful, I need to share this with someone, right? And your stories about people not wanting to read totally disheartened me as well, but like that meaning being found in what you read as well, right? So really, you're all little kind of perverse superheroes up there for us in some ways, because you've done this. Like this is what we all want to be doing, and you've done it. So in even in that way, you've created this meaning for us. You know what I mean? Like, so it kind of, it just, I think, compels itself. Whether or not it grows is completely, doesn't matter. I don't think. Like, if it compels itself and it's maintaining itself and that meaning still exists, and I can say to someone, you know, yeah, that was like totally catachresis, and they can kind of know what I'm saying, like even just like a connection in understanding and meaning and knowing, then it's totally worth it. It doesn't
matter. The difference between art and therapy? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's the difference between getting something, you know, just airing something that's meaningful and it being somehow immortal and being able to be passed down through time? Like, I'm interested in this question personally. How would you answer that? What's the difference between
it just being,
you said passing on meaning, so like what's the difference between just doing that in this sort of way of catharsis, expression, and it being art, something more?
Well,
do you know what I mean?
Is it about finding out the quest for immortality for some sort of like larger purpose, or is it about the process? Is that what you're?
Well, it was just the word meaning. When she was using the word meaning, I sort of thought, wow, that's a huge word. I mean, there's.
I have an answer. When therapy, when therapy becomes universal, then it's art.
And I think it's about connecting with an audience. You talk about finding an audience, however small. Therapy is like you can just write.
Mm-hmm.
But communicating is a different game. Like I couldn't analyze it, but it is, you know, or it's what you talk about. You know, an editor goes, "This is how the world. This is what you have on the page. Is that what you want?" You know, that's a kind of communication. But therapy is about, well, I've done it, I've spilled my guts, I've yelled at my mother, and and it's over. But, you know, there's levels of craft. That's what you're talking about, reading and stuff. I mean, one thing, this is slightly shifting, but one thing I liked about the split MA program here, half academic, half workshop, was, holy shit, do your standards ever have to go up? When you're scribbling your story in the morning and then you're reading James Joyce in the afternoon, you better get your shit together. You know? Like even if you fail, but you better know that there's a difference. And I found that really
teaches you how to fail better, maybe.
Yeah.
Closer to the ideal. How has the program changed? I guess since you've been here. Right now, you have to take 4 academic courses and 4 workshop or creative writing courses. And I wonder if there was more. You said there was more of an emphasis on the academic when you were here.
Well, we had to do 1 workshop, and then there were these creative courses for the creative writing side, which were essentially reading courses, but you know, looking at, I don't know if they might be the same now, but looking at books from a more writer's craft point of view. But they were essentially literature courses. Is it different now? Do you have to do more?
There's still techniques of writing courses, but it's... There are four and four, so it's a bit more evenly split, although the creative writing thesis is still fully creative. I know some programs have a sort of prefatory essay or whatever.
And when I was here, I did a full year fiction and a full year poetry, and then my thesis was a play. So, and then the rest was, I can't remember how many academic courses. I think they were mostly half a year.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I saw a few hands up.
I guess I just wonder what I found like doing a university degree kind of approach to writing does to your idea of audience. Like, who does that make you feel like you're writing for afterwards? When you know, you talk about the world, and it's like, you know, my editor will show me how the world is going to read this, but like, who is this world, you know? And like, which section are you addressing, and like, how do you reconcile that? You know, if some people are, you know, some people will sort of tell you, well, this is very elitist, like this is very like, now you're addressing the overeducated snobs, you know, and like, I think that's something you have to like sort of decide like how you feel about that. I'm just wondering what kind of like decisions you guys have made about audience.
Your work is already performed or presented in different ways, so also might be interesting to get different perspectives of theatrical and then theatrical plus literary poetry fiction.
Well, my sense of it is that it's a question that's asked less earnestly in the poetry world than it is in the fiction or theatrical world, because novels and theater, I guess, are bread and butter arts, right? You can earn a living doing it, and so it's important that people come see your play. It's important that people buy your books, you know, and all of that is based on sort of not just awards or prizes, but like, you know, readership, you know. Poets have given up on readership, although they haven't given up on like, you know, awards and prizes. So it's a question that's asked less and less. And you get into trouble in the poetry world when you ask those questions. So when you say, who's reading this? And does it even matter? You know, then you get into trouble. People accuse you of being like, you know, a curmudgeon and all of that. But once you start asking questions about readership, public reception, the effect a certain poem has on, like, you know, this perceived, you know, reader, and ask questions of like worth and necessity, and you know, then you get into trouble. But I think those questions are asked more regularly and lead to more healthy results in the other arts. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I find in fiction that there's no, there's no science to how audiences respond. Nobody knows why a certain book does well. A difficult book, you know, why did The Name of the Rose, which was this thick tome that was, you know, a bit of a slog to get through, sold in the millions, and other books don't. Publishers don't know which books are going to do well. They highly promote certain books, and they just fizzle out. Books that didn't expect to go anywhere suddenly take off. You know, Carol Shields had been writing for years and years and years. I don't think she'd ever sold more than 5,000 copies of a book when the Stone Diaries came out. The Stone Diaries suddenly became this runaway bestseller, won all sorts of prizes.
But that bears out the point, though, because that it's a bestseller because people buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
So approbation comes from like scale. In poetry, it comes from poets. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
from,
I guess
this
part
is
of the question is,
yeah,
like, does that mean that if you're writing poetry, you are writing only for other people who also write poetry, or whether there's
an audience composed of people like me who have my taste, but even then, a lot of my books I don't like very much, so I wouldn't get very far on that front. You sort of write the book that you can, and the book that you're able to write, and hope that it creates an audience that it responds to.
But I have to say the prose, it seems to me, I haven't written it, so maybe I'm just talking shit here, but prose as a genre are the private thoughts that you have to write in public ways. I mean, if you're telling a story, then the act of telling a story means that you by default, you're imagining an audience listening to it. Poetry, however, are very private thoughts that are written in very private ways. So it's a very.
I think it's a bit of a false distinction.
Yeah.
You're still structuring language to communicate.
Yeah.
You're still doing the same thing.
Yeah, but you have characters, you
have
anecdotes, you have like situations, drama.
Poetry can have those things. I mean, you know, like there are poetic tropes of musicality and imagery in prose and storytelling tropes in poetry, you know, of a progression and through time and characters who evolve, you know. That.
But if you push the novel too much in that direction, then you get something quite unreadable.
Yeah,
but you were saying, for example, Eunoia, which is hardly an easy read.
Again,
why? Well, it has to do with a lot
50,
of things that maybe
readers can't
have
be wrong,
to do with things out there.
I want to remind you have another crack at these four this evening at the 7:30 reading at the Dessau Cinemas, but we can take probably one more question right now.
What is that?
Alas, well, we can.
I just wanted to go back to that question about art and therapy, which I think is, and where the distinction is perhaps between a public, a private catharsis in your shrink's office and a public catharsis through your writing, and that sort of narcissistic belief that your catharsis on the page might lead other people to recognize that they have to do that as well.
Might not.
but somehow that's somehow perhaps a more meaningful catharsis. Whereas if you're venting at the shrink's office, you know, perhaps it's giving it a more selfless, I suppose, to air your catharsis in public and then perhaps, yeah, give someone the opportunity. Isn't that somehow what you hope as an artist, is that, hey, this person recognizes my problem, perhaps, or is that not?
That reminds me when Nino was just saying about how, like, you know, you're not necessarily thinking about the audience, you're thinking about this universe of the text, right? And so things are happening to you while you're writing it, and you can't know whether those same light bulbs are going to go on for somebody else or not. You know, am I understood? Is this on? You know.
Yeah. I mean, if you get one.
Yeah, one person is fine. If somebody comes up after a thing and says, I like the part where you said the thing about the turtle, and I'm like, wow. That blows my mind. She's going to take home the image of the turtle, and it doesn't even exist except this thing. That's a trip, but that's icing, you know. Sorry, Carmen.
No, you're absolutely right. I was just going to say that I saw this movie recently called The Best of Youth. I don't know if anyone's seen it. I mean, just a splendid film, 6-hour epic. It's actually done as a TV program, and it's an Italian film, and they repackaged it into two volumes, 3 hours each. And it follows the life of a family over 37 years, starting 1966 to 2003. It was enormously moving. The story of two brothers, Matteo and Nicola, and at the end of it, I was weeping. It was just a profound movie. And the next day, you know, I dropped by my mother's and I hugged her and I just a bit more tightly because of that film. It moved me so much. And then I can't help but ask myself, have my poems ever done that? If after reading one of my poems, have you hugged your mother more tightly? For the right reasons, you know?
Reader surveys.
But, well, I mean, I'd want to know the answer.
Know
but the, I think those are important questions as artists. You know? I mean, that's, you know, more than what's happening on the page. Is this, you know, are you colliding with lives, with minds, with emotions, you know? Are you, you know, I'm a different person after having seen that film. My relationship to my parents, my family is very different now. I mean, it's richer. I can't explain it. The movie was just so important to me, you know? And I would only hope that once, at least once in my life, I could write something that could do that for somebody else. You know? More important than the avant-garde, more important than, like, sales, more important than prizes, you know, just connecting.
Well, as always, there are always more questions than answers, unfortunately, and I hate to abridge this because it's a good, you know, just getting going. We haven't even had any good fights yet. But I want to maybe finish off by just asking each of you if you had the chance to do it again, to do the MA again, if you, whether you would or not.
Yes. I figure if I answer first, I can leave more legroom for everybody.
Oh, it's so not the same thing. I mean, if I did it again, I'd get more out of it now, and I'd know what I was doing, as I didn't when I did do the degree. But I think that was part, you know, part of the point. You know, if I could learn how to talk again, would I do it? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, looking at it from now, I stumbled into it so naively, and I learned how to talk that way, and so, you know. You can't go back there.
It's a loaded question.
Sure, absolutely. I'd go out of the Coast Guard. But no,
Coast Guard.
Right, scuba. I'll take scuba.
Coast Guard. I do the Coast Guard.
You're right about it.
Yeah.
Yes, I definitely would. But you know, as Catherine's saying, it's hard to know what might have happened otherwise. But certainly, judging the effect that it had on my life. It really set me on my path as well.
That bodes well for a lot of us, I guess. Well, please join me in thanking our superheroes, Heather Collins.
Yeah.